Then he returned and asked them to reconcile with him. With regard to Sweden, when he threatened Sweden under the pretext that it supports terrorism, as Erdogan said, he meant the Kurdistan Workers' Party and the Kurdish and Syrian People's Protection Units, as well as the preacher Fethullah Gulen. Erdogan knows that those who support this terrorism are the United States of America before Sweden. America is the one who supports the Kurdish militias in the east of the Euphrates. And occupies the east of the Euphrates. And regarding the preacher Fethullah Gulen, whom Erdogan accused of planning and supporting the failed coup in 2016, Fethullah Gulen resides in the United States of America itself. So this position is not a serious one for President Erdogan. And as I said, it is nothing but internal marketing on the basis of national, religious and sectarian slogans to which the Turkish people are accustomed. To a point that the supporters and followers of Erdogan say that he is a world leader and the leader of the Arab and Islamic nation and whatnot, and that he is the heir of the Ottoman Caliphate. Even if he made a mistake, in their view, he knows why he made that mistake. That is, in their view, there must be an idea in President Erdogan's head, at least according to his followers and his supporters.
That's really interesting, because before the last elections and during the weeks and months that led to those elections, we heard Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, just as you said, threatening the United States of America, threatening the NATO, and also the countries of the European Union themselves, and said more than once that he will never accept Sweden into NATO. But how are his supporters and his foes as well? Because you just said that his supporters might give him some sort of benefit of the doubt of why he's doing what he's doing. But what about his foes? I mean, how are they receiving his sudden change of heart concerning NATO?
They never stand up to it. This issue or this question needs to be answered by conducting a social and psychological study of the followers and supporters of President Erdogan. Simply because there is no logic in the stances that President Erdogan has taken in recent years. As he threatens everyone, then returns and reconciles with everyone. Exactly as I said with regard to Saudi Arabia, the Emirates and Egypt. Even former US President Donald Trump in 2019 threatened Erdogan and sent him a message insulting him and literally telling him not to be stupid. But Erdogan ignored this message and begged the United States of America so that Trump would send him another message to visit the White House. This is the case now with President Biden. As when Erdogan agreed to Sweden joining NATO, he wished that President Biden would invite him to the White House, and he will soon be fulfilled, according to media reports. As for the biggest lie, it was when he said that there would be a reward for Turkey for it, allowing Sweden to join NATO, which is that the doors of the European Union would be fully open to the Turks. The strange thing is that Erdogan's followers and supporters believe this, forgetting that Erdogan has no intention of joining the European Union because he does not believe it benefits him ideologically and religiously. Because he believes that he is the heir of the Ottoman Empire that occupied half of Europe. Therefore, this approach is of course not serious, because Turkey has been waiting at the gates of the European Union since 1963. I repeat, this issue requires a social and psychological study.
Something that is very interesting that came out of Mr. Erdogan with his newest position was the provocation against Russia. It seems like he's challenging Russia on purpose. I mean, before 2 days just before the NATO summit last week, he extended an urgent and very surprising invitation to the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, to visit him in Istanbul, and he gave him five of the most infamous Azov leaders who were handed to Turkey by Moscow, but the deal was that they will stay in Ankara till after the end of the war, but that did not happen as well. That was just a couple of many other provocations against Russia. How do you think this episode of insulting Russia will end?
I do not think that the relationship between Russia and Turkey will deteriorate and end, because there is a long history between Russia as an empire and later as the Soviet Union and between Turkey. The age of this relationship is about 500 years old and witnessed about 16 wars, during which the Russians won 11 wars and Turkey won 5 of them. With regard to the recent developments as mentioned in the question, this is not the only provocation. We know that there is a strategic military cooperation between Kiev and Ankara, especially in the matters of military drones. And especially during Zelensky's recent visit to Istanbul, it was agreed to manufacture Turkish drones inside Ukrainian territory. However, we must remember that the provocation, as it is called, about the Turkish position against the Russians is not new. We know how President Erdogan did not abide by the Skopje Agreement on the issue of Idlib and northern Syria, just as he did not abide by the Moscow Agreement of March 2020. Also, with regard to the withdrawal of terrorist elements from Idlib, as well as sitting at the negotiating table with President Assad. But as I said, Erdogan did not abide by this issue, just as he did not abide by the tripartite special agreement between Turkey, Azerbaijan, Armenia and Russia regarding the situation in the Caucasus. The Turkish army is now in the Caucasus and it is a provocative position against the Russians. Likewise, President Erdogan's policies in Central Asia, where the republics are of Turkish origin, and we know that these republics are indeed Russia's backyard. This is also one of President Erdogan's veiled provocations against Russia.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you think those would do with the upcoming visit of President Putin to Turkey? Do you think President Putin might cancel his visit to Istanbul?
I think so. Although there are intense efforts by President Erdogan to appease to President Putin to visit Turkey as soon as possible, so that at least it is not said that Erdogan is the one who spoiled the Turkish-Russian relationship. Because this relationship has many very important aspects, the most important of which are the 4 nuclear reactors that Russia is building inside Turkish lands. In addition to that, Russia covers about 50% of the gas consumed in Turkey. So Erdogan is trying at least to tidy up the issue until he can arrange the matter strategically and not tactically with the United States of America, especially after his expected visit there, as well as arranging the situation of the regional security after his ongoing visit now to Saudi Arabia, Qatar and the Emirates.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Hosni Mahalli is a researcher in international relations and expert in Turkish affairs. Thank you very much for joining us from Istanbul. It's an honor, sir, to have you with us to talk about these issues. Ladies and gents, thank you very much. I'll see you again next week on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Respected scholars and elders and brothers and sisters, Adhamallahu ujuruna wa ujurakum bi musabina bil Husayn alayhi salam. The title of the series is Karbala, the Enlightened Journey. Now that is a generic title, but inshallah you'll see in the course of the nights, those of you who will be with us, that these words were chosen with precision, meaning that there is something we're going to describe about Karbala and enlightenment. Now, in order to introduce the topic, I want to take us to the years leading up to the tragedy of Ashura. And we want to evaluate what's happening in the Muslim Ummah at that time. From some perspectives, if we were to look at history, things were actually going pretty well from some criteria. You know, when you want to evaluate something, what's really important is you have to see what criteria are you using to evaluate. Because depending on that, your results are going to differ. So from some criteria, things were going pretty well. For example, if you were to take a poll and statistics and you say the number of those who had memorized the Quran in the Muslim Ummah from the time of our Prophet to the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, you'd see that the graph is increasing. People were memorizing the Quran. People were gaining more familiarity with the teachings of the Quran, at least on an outer level. There were people who were living beyond the Prophet's time, meaning that they lived past the Prophet, people who were the writers of the wahy of the Quran, meaning that they could tell stories about how different ayat were revealed at different times. There was people who were living at that time who could tell the stories of what happened in Badr and Uhud and Khandaq and all these Ahzab, all these great battles. They could tell these stories. You could go and meet these living legends. People like Ammar, people like Salman, at least for some time, they were alive. From some perspective, things were going well. The mosques might have been full at that time. The Quran was being read. There were even people who were there who, let's say people didn't understand the position of the Ahlul Bayt being the divine representatives, at least they could go and say that these are the family of the Prophet. And they could go and they could see them, they could interact with them. Right? Things were, from some perspectives, they were looking pretty good. But you and I know that at the same time that these apparent manifestations of Islam, maybe they were going in a good direction, at the same time there was a deep sickness that was growing in the Muslim Ummah at that time. And it's this sickness that I want to kind of dig into. I want to try to see if we can come up, use a word to describe this sickness. But in order to do that, I would like to first take us to the Quran, where Allah Ta'ala, in four verses of the Quran, He mentions a particular term, which inshallah we're going to be using throughout the course of these lectures. What is this term? Let me mention a couple of these ayat. The first one is Surah Al-Ahzab. Allah Ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وقرنا في بيوتكن ولا تبرجن تبرج الجاهلية الأولى. This command is for the wives of the Prophet, specifically, where Allah Ta'ala tells them that you stay in your homes. Right? This was a special command for the wives of the Prophet. And then He gives a command of another command, which applies to the wives of the Prophet first and foremost, but then also it's a general command, which is what? Do not do tabarruj. Tabarruj comes from the word buruj, like towers. Right? You know how they're very apparent. You can see them from far away. Allah says that don't do things so that you are visible like towers. Now then He describes those particular activities that would make a lady, a female, visible by saying that that is the type of activity that belongs to al-jahiliyatil ula. Jahiliyah, of course, means the era or the mannerisms of ignorance, the lifestyle of ignorance. That's ayah number one. Ayah number two, Allah Ta'ala is describing in Surah Ali Imran what happened in the Battle of Uhud. Now you know from Islamic history that Battle of Uhud was a difficult battle for the Muslims. Because at one point, you know, they were in the lead and then things went completely the other way. And they ended up losing a lot of casualties. Even some thought that our Prophet, our beloved Prophet, had been killed. And there was a lot of grief that took place after this battle. So what happened? Allah Ta'ala describes the people at that time. And He says that there was a group of amongst them, قَدْ أَهَمَّتْهُمْ أَنفُسُهُمْ يَظُنُّونَ بِاللَّهِ ظَنَّ الْجَاهِلِيَةِ. There was people who were thinking and they were suspecting and thinking and they were bringing back the beliefs of the era of ignorance, the jahiliyyah. Okay, what's the story behind that? It's very interesting. There were some people who had a very black and white understanding of the way this world works. They used to think that, if you just, all you got to do if you want to make it in this world is you got to find the right God to connect to, right? So let's say, for example, the stone God is your good luck God. Then if you go to that stone God, then you're going to find success in everything that you do. You'll win all your battles. You'll get all your trade the way you want it. And you'll even get married on top of that. Everything's going to be good for you, okay? But if it doesn't work, then you go to the wood God. Maybe that's going to work for you. So they used to think that depending on how you chose your God, you just connected to the right, sort of deity, then success is guaranteed for you. So they were thinking that, okay, we know that our prophet is the prophet. We know Islam is the religion. So then, of course we're going to be victorious. Everything we do, we're going to find success in. What was wrong here? The thing that was wrong in their thinking is that now when they started to see that failure, they started to think that, hey, maybe we didn't connect to the right deity, right? Maybe this whole approach of trusting solely in Allah and letting him determine the results is not the right approach to take. So Allah reveals a verse and he corrects their thinking. Don't go back to that way of thinking. Now you're supposed to be elevated in your thinking. You have one source, one mudabbir, one entity that manages your affairs, one entity in which you trust, one who is in charge. But you should know that that one who is in charge acts according to wisdom and according to a certain system. At times you may see success. At times you might see apparent failure. But as long as you're doing your duty, you are still successful. So Allah corrects their thinking. And there's other ayat as well that I'm not going to mention right now. But what I do want to say is that in the Quran, at times Allah warns people that now that you have Islam, don't go back to Jahiliyyah. Jahiliyyah, the era of ignorance, as you can see from these examples, it can apply to the way we do things, our actions. It can apply to the way that we perceive things, our beliefs. And in other examples, it can be in the way that we construct our ethical system, the way we see our values. All of them can be fall under Jahiliyyah. Now, it's very interesting, brothers and sisters. There were people who would read these ayat of the Quran and they would memorize them and they would think about them and reflect upon them, and sometimes they would have a question. So in this case, I'm sure there's a question that came to many of your mind, which was the following, that why is it that Allah describes the Jahiliyyah as being al-Jahiliyyah al-Ula? Why does He describe it as being the first Jahiliyyah? What does that mean? So this question was posed of the Ahlul Bayt to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam. And in riwayat, in ahadith, in narrations, we're told in a few of them, they say that the same way that there was a time of ignorance, there was a period and a lifestyle of ignorance, the same way that there will come again a period of ignorance as well. And in one tradition, we're told that our prophet says that that second period of ignorance will be worse than the first period of ignorance.
Oh, Hussein, you live forever in our hearts and in our minds. I swear to Allah, unto my last breath, I will remember to Allah whenever I face troubles in my life. I close my eyes and see your shrine and call back every time. Oh, Hussein, you're the love of my heart. You are the light of my eyes. I swear to Allah, until my last breath, I will remember Hussein.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
7 barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. My condolences to the Imam of the time, to the Muslim Ummah, especially the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, on the advent of the month of tears, on the advent of the month of grief, on the advent of the month of sorrows, on the advent of the month of purification. The month of Muharram, the month in which the greatest person on earth at that particular time, the closest person to the greatest of all creations of all times, was martyred in a brutal manner along with his companions, his children, his family members, after a period of time where they had no water or they had denied water under the baking sun on the plains of Karbala in the city of current day Iraq. So first and foremost, again, we send our condolences to the Imam of the time, Imam al-Sahib al-Asri wa-Zaman, and we ask him that the Imam allows us to do the same for him, inshallah. We are part of those who are the true servants of the Imam, alayhi, as those companions of Imam al-Husayn alayhi, were to him. Inshallah, the event of Karbala has been narrated, has been mentioned, has been documented in many different ways. Some obviously are more authentic than others. One of the most authentic manners is obviously eyewitness accounts of those who were there, and none other than obviously the children of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So inshallah, in our next segment we'll be introducing a book that deals with the subject of an eyewitness account of one of the children of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we would like to introduce to you all is titled The Tragedy of Karbala, as narrated by Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn al-Sajjad alayhi salam. That is the fourth holy Imam, the son of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, a person who was present on the day of Karbala, a person who was present on the plains of Karbala on the day of Ashura. This particular narration is from the chain of narrators of Sheikh Saduq rahmatullah alayhi in his book Al-Amali. Al-Amali, within the Shi'i school of thought, is when a scholar narrates certain traditions via and with their chains, that is, the chain of narrators who narrated to him and so on and so forth, to a group of students who then write it down and then re-present it to the scholar in order to ensure that what they written was correct. There are a few al-amalis within the Shia school of thought, but inshallah that's for another time. This book was then translated by Abdul Zahra Abdul Hussein. Again, it was published by the Islamic Publishing House in Toronto, Canada. So, at the back of the book, the blurb says this: Although there were many witnesses to this massacre, that is the event and the sorrowful and painful event on the day of Ashura, most notably official reporters such as Humayd ibn Muslim. Some say Humayd, some say Hamid, a different of opinion here. But Humayd ibn Muslim, one of the few male survivors from the Ahlul Bayt to tell us what transpired on that horrific day, was Imam Ali Zainul Abidin, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, the son of Imam Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salam. The Tragedy of Karbala, this book that we have introduced to our dear listeners, is a complete translation of the hadith which chronicles the events of the day of Ashura as recounted by Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. This historical narration is based on that which is found in the book Al-A'mali as narrated by the late Sheikh Saduq rahmatullah alayhi, and is presented here in English along with its original Arabic. So the book again is divided into two sections. The first section of the book being the English translation of the tradition of the hadith, and then the second section being the original Arabic of the same hadith that has been translated into English, obviously, for people who want to read it on the mimbar for the sake of the masa'ib and for the grieving ritual and the grieving for the month of Muharram. So inshallah, please stay tuned, dear listeners, for we'll be reading a portion of this book, of this tradition, in fact, for the benefit of us all in this blessed month of Muharram. So please stay tuned.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd. Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name? Is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. The book that we have introduced to our dear listeners is titled The Tragedy of Karbala, as narrated by Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn al-Sajjad alayhi salam, translated by Abdul Zahra Abdul Husayn. So we're reading from the beginning of the hadith, from the tradition. The Tragedy of Karbala, English translation. In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Saturday, the 9th of Muharram, in 386 AH, is the day that coincided with the eve of the martyrdom of Imam al-Husayn ibn Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. The grand and virtuous scholar, Sheikh Abu Ja'far Muhammad ibn Ali ibn Al-Husayn ibn Musa ibn Babawi al-Qummi, may Allah be pleased with him. And then he goes on and he mentions all those who narrated this tradition to him, the whole chain of narration, all the way up to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, who then said that my father Al-Baqir alayhi salam has narrated to me, who narrated from his father, that is Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, who said, when Muawiyah was approaching his death, he called upon his son Yazid and set him in his presence. He said to him, son, I've humiliated the necks of the people for you and granted you the nations and left the power and the pleasures associated with it for you. However, I fear for you three people who will be fierce in their opposition to you, and they are Abdullah ibn Umar ibn al-Khattab, that is the son of the second Khalif, Abdullah ibn al-Zubair, that is the son of Zubair who was killed at the battle of Jamal, and Al-Husayn ibn Ali alayhi salam, is the son of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that in this month of Muharram, we're able to purify ourselves, we're able to attach ourselves to the doyen of the martyrs, to the Sayyid of the Shuhada, that is to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And the way we have a successful month of Muharram, and may we be of those who, because of this Muharram, become the true servants and true companions of the Imam of the time, Imam al-Sahib al-Asri wal-Zaman. Inshallah, until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasser Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
After 5 years of investigation, the U.S. President's only living son has agreed to plead guilty to 2 tax violations and a gun charge. Most likely, he will not stay a day in jail, shedding light on the Department of Justice's favorite treatment of the President's son. Hunter has also been involved in a shady business with China and Ukraine, which might have involved the President himself. He has recently settled a case with his daughter, whom he has never met, and the president has refrained from acknowledging her existence. The media are now revealing the hypocrisy of Biden's talk of family. Hunting Hunter. Hunter Biden is an American lawyer, businessman, and an artist who gained significant attention due to his association with his father, Joe Biden, who was a former senator, vice president, and now is the current president of the United States. Hunter Biden was born on February 4, 1970, in Wilmington, Delaware. He's the son of Joe Biden and his first wife, Nellie Hunter Biden. Hunter's mother and younger sister died in a car accident shortly before Christmas in 1972. His father later married Jill Biden, and Hunter had a young brother named Boo Biden. Boo passed away in 2015 due to a brain cancer. Hunter earned a Bachelor of Arts degree from Georgetown University and later completed a Juris Doctor degree from Yale Law School in 1996. He has recently pleaded guilty to tax evasion charges in a deal with prosecutors.
The Delaware-based federal judge set to preside over Hunter Biden's arraignment is facing mounting pressure by former Department of Justice officials to reject his plea deal, as a majority of the nation says the president's son received, quote, sweetheart treatment. Some have even spoken out to insist the agreement struck between Biden and U.S. Attorney for the District of Delaware, David Weiss, backs up recent claims made by IRS whistleblower Gary Shapley in testimony to Congress. Shapley, a current IRS agent, said he was barred from taking certain actions, which may have led to the president himself. But Attorney General Merrick Garland has said there was no interference despite Shapley's refusal to back down. Weiss has since reiterated he was given ultimate authority over the investigation, including for deciding where, when, and whether to file charges. However, Representative Jim Jordan has now called Weiss, along with 11 other employees at the DOJ, to sit for transcribed interviews before Congress.
Hunter Biden, son of President Joe Biden, has found himself embroiled in a series of controversies over the years, from his business dealings in China and Ukraine to allegations of tax evasions, which he has pleaded guilty to, child support disputes, and a well-documented battle with drug addiction. His actions have garnered significant attention and scrutiny. Approaching the U.S. presidential elections have once again put the president's son in the spotlight. What are the controversies surrounding Hunter Biden?
the question that's surrounding Hunter Biden is Hunter Biden at the behest of his father, from what we're now finding out, has been doing business with a foreign government. He's not registered to do business with a foreign government, but he has made a living and a lifestyle for him and himself and his father in receiving monies from various sources that are illegal because they did not go through the proper channels within our government, nor did they go through with the knowledge of the full knowledge of the State Department. So that's the controversy where he's a lot of Americans are now seeing that family as a family that's highly corrupt, as a family where that corruption must end. And he's not the only one. There's a lot of other parts to this, because he's been allowed to get away with this and no one questioned his actions or his motive. Well, I believe, honestly, that he has been used by Joe Biden, his father, and he's been put in the middle of something he probably didn't want to be involved in because of all the controversies surrounding Hunter Biden. So that's what is going on right now here in the United States, trying to weed through where the money came from and how that money was being dispersed or given to him, his father, and other members of his family who've been partaking in illegal funds.
Hunter Biden's involvement with foreign business entities has been a subject of intense scrutiny, notably his position on the board of Burisma Holdings, a Ukrainian natural gas company, raised questions of potential conflicts of interests given his father's role as vice president at the time. Critics argued that Hunter's appointment seemed to exploit his family name and position for personal gain.
Some of the controversies that he faces revolve typically around his son, because his son has played as an intermediary with foreign governments, and especially business dealings in foreign nations like China and Ukraine. That's one of the major points of bringing up Hunter Biden and his connection. And so I think that's one of the major controversies, because it talks about public corruption and how some public officials may be using their children as a means to funnel money from foreign nations or foreign business entities into their own pockets.
On June 22 this year, a WhatsApp message released by a congressional committee investigating the presidential family revealed that Hunter Biden was threatening his Chinese business associate in July 2017. In the message, Hunter Biden writes that he's sitting with his father and they would both like to understand why the commitment made has not been fulfilled. He then says he will make sure by using his father's power, the associate will regret not following Hunter's direction.
One of the things that it says that we are supposed to be a nation, and we're known for being a nation that obey and respect the rule of law. But the corruption that the world is now seeing, and now people think that the United States may have a little hypocrisy because we've traveled around the world to be the enforcement around the world when it comes to human rights violations, or when it comes to genocide or people taking advantage of others, dictators destroying entire nations. We've built that reputation. We've always lived up to that reputation. But now, with this Hunter Biden situation, with this Hillary Clinton false dossier situation, and with the covering up of about 30,000 emails, the world is now laughing at us. But the corruption is deep, and it's dark, and it's ugly, and it's mean. And it's time now that if we're serious about restoring our integrity and restoring our credibility around the world, then we must deal with this Hunter Biden scandal, with this computer, where you find a lot of different things on his computer that leads back to his father and his uncles and a lot of his family members and also the Obamas. It reaches that far back. So eventually, you can run from justice, but you cannot hide from the arms of justice.
The president denied being with Hunter when he sent a message, and White House counsel spokesperson Ian Sams denied Biden had any involvement, saying the president was not in business with his son. A political analyst, has stated that Hunter Biden has been a problem for a very long time and the president is extremely sensitive about criticism of his son, which makes the people around Joe Biden reluctant to say anything on the topic.
How involved were you in your son's Chinese shakedown text message? Were you sitting there? Were you involved?
No, I wasn't, and I don't know.
Were you?
No!
Republicans took control of the House after the 2020 midterm elections, and the Oversight and Accountability Committee launched a probe into the Biden's family business dealings. The probe is mostly aimed towards Hunter and the president's brother James and their businesses in countries like Ukraine and China. The committee has found a total of close to $2.5 million wired to and from businesses and associates linked to the Biden family and a China-based investment fund.
Hunter's business dealings basically just exemplify what's much of what's wrong within D.C., especially the federal government, but throughout many other governments, the state government as well, in some ways. We have a lot of politicians who are finding ways to profit off of their status and their position, not through just book deals that seem like possibly a way to funnel money, by allegedly selling copies of their book, but through using their children to sit on boards for companies and industries they have no interest or knowledge in. We've seen that with Nancy Pelosi's kids, with the Clintons and their daughter Chelsea. You know, they always find some way to be a board member somewhere. Getting paid an exorbitant amount of money, for what reason? And so I think Joe Biden's case seems to be a lot more smoke to show that there may be something that's actually there. And the laptop situation highlighted even more so between the email conversations and what appears to be explicitly stating that Joe Biden is getting a cut of the money he was getting from Burisma.
Chairman of the House Oversight and Accountability Committee, James Comer, has said if President Biden is compromised by deals with foreign adversaries and they are impacting his decision-making, this is a threat to national security. Also, while Joe Biden was vice president and investigating corruption in Ukraine, Hunter served on the board of Burisma Holdings, a large Ukrainian gas company, for 5 years with no experience in the energy industry.
These are not politically charged crimes against the Biden. Jim Jordan and a lot of the other congressional representatives have been doing the investigations for a great many years, have now found that the following the money, all the money that has been tracked now through the banks by a lot of the investigations that's going on, and not by the FBI or the Department of Justice, but by due diligence congressional and senatorial representatives such as Chuck Grassley, who he's the U.S. senator. He's been on there, Senator Ron Johnson, Jim Jordan, Matt Gaetz, all of them have been doing their due diligence, and they have now, and we now have the evidence to prove that these are not politically motivated charges. These are real, actual charges that has been kept from the public view by our media and by our law enforcement entities or institutions such as the Department of Justice and the FBI. So no, the charges that they now have on Hunter Biden are real charges in which he should have met justice a long time ago. But for some reason or another, we've had a lot of the interferences from Joe Biden, from Nancy Pelosi, and a lot of other tentacles are trying to protect Hunter Biden. Because as I stated earlier, if Hunter Biden fall, a lot of heads will roll. And they're trying to do everything they can to protect him because he's not the only one that's been doing this for these many, 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 many years. As I stated, I believe that it started when Bill Clinton gave China the most favorite nation status. And he opened up the door to deal with a lot of the countries that was placed on our United States Treasury sanction list. And for that reason alone, I think that that was the beginning of something that we now cannot put back in the Pandora box.
Hunter Biden published a memoir in 2021 admitting to the use of crack cocaine and alcoholism, stating that he has received treatment and recovered from his addictions. However, just recently a powdered substance was found in the White House, and upon examination, it was determined to be cocaine. Donald Trump and many other critics are accusing Hunter of bringing the substance into the White House. Will the cocaine fiasco be swept under the rug?
I believe this may actually be swept under the rug. It's very early in reports coming out, so I don't believe that anybody knows where this may have come from or where exactly they found it in the White House. That I'm not aware of, or if there's any official reports to come out to indicate it. So for all we know, it was Hunter Biden or it was a staffer. We have no idea. I'm not sure if this situation is the biggest of big deals as far as finding illicit drugs, because we don't know the quantity. We don't know if it was just a trace. We have no idea. And there's lots of people that work within the White House and the executive branch. So will it get swept under the rug? Possibly, because there may not be that much there to really report on other than just finding drugs within the White House. But are they above the law? Yeah, possibly.
The problems do not stop with drugs. Hunter has recently settled a child support case with a former stripper from Arkansas who has given birth to a girl. DNA results prove Hunter Biden to be the 4-year-old girl's father, and therefore she would be the president's granddaughter. Joe Biden, presiding himself as a family man, has said in April that he has 6 grandchildren and is crazy about them, not acknowledging his 7th granddaughter.
I would later challenge in court the woman from Arkansas who had a baby in 2018 and claimed the child was mine. I had no recollection of our encounter.
But a DNA test proved that Hunter Biden is the girl's biological father. He now pays $20,000 a month in child support. But Little Navy has never been acknowledged by the Biden family.
Girl has no contact with the Biden family. She's never been able to meet her grandparents. She's never gotten to go to the White House. Her grandfather has never picked her up and held her. And then she has a father who has no connection with her and is claiming that he doesn't have enough money to care for her.
Just last week, the president spoke proudly about all his grandchildren, but left Navy out.
I have my oldest granddaughter, her name is Naomi. And then I have number 2, and her name is Finnegan. Number 3, Maisie. And then I have Natalie. And then I have a grandson who's going to be a senior in high school. Now I have a new baby boy. He's 3.5 years old, and he's Beau Biden. So, and guess what? They're crazy about me.
I think it's embarrassing that the president doesn't acknowledge this grandkid that looks just like his son. That's the sad part.
The terms of the settlement was not made public, but attorneys have revealed that Hunter was become a painter and whose pieces have been offered to as much as $500,000 apiece would give a number of his paintings to his daughter along with a monthly support payment. Before the settlement, he had paid his daughter's mother $750,000 and tried to reduce his $20,000 a month child support payment.
The violation of one law invalidates all law. And if we're not going to enforce the law on Hunter Biden, then we should let all those in our prisons go, because we're now showing that the United States is not the enforcement or the enforcer of his laws or her laws, and we cannot uphold that standard or lower the bar of standards where you have people going to jail being arrested for not paying their child support, or you have people who if a police officer stop them and he see there's a weapon in the car, see there's a gun in the car, then they are charged and they're prosecuted and they're convicted on the concealment of a weapon. But not Hunter Biden. Hunter Biden is no different than you or I. He's not the president of the United States. He's not a United States senator. He's not even a congressperson. He doesn't hold any other position other than he's getting paid by China, getting paid by Ukraine, and getting paid by all these other countries that are on our section list that we're not supposed to be doing business with, according to our law. You cannot enforce our law when you allow an individual like Hunter Biden, because he's the president's son. Joe Biden did not win that election. President Trump was overthrown. And this is what America has to come to terms with, and we must stop being in denial. President Trump never lost the election. So Joe Biden, they overthrew him, so he could not bring justice to Hunter Biden.
If you think Hunter Biden's problems stop there, think again. On June 20th, he reached an agreement with federal prosecutors on tax and gun charges. The U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Delaware had accused Hunter of failing to file his taxes correctly in 2017 and 18. He had not paid the income tax due for either year, despite owing more than $100,000 in federal income tax each year. Why does Hunter get off so easy from the charges filed against him?
He gets off easy because the most powerful and the wealthiest people tend to get off easy. Unfortunately, you know, our system of crime and punishment isn't 100% when it comes to being fair. There are ways to maneuver around it. If you have enough money, you can afford the best attorneys. If you have enough influence, you can create an illusion of justice where, you know, they make a slap on the wrist appear like a severe punishment just to show that they did something and that they didn't completely ignore it. So how does he get away with it? Because he's the son of the president. It's the same reason why Hunter has gotten away with a lot of things. So none of this really surprises me. It's unfortunate. It does happen, but that's the reason why.
The allegations from the district's attorney's office also included a firearm purchase in 2018 while he was addicted to a controlled substance. Hunter Biden came to an agreement, pleading guilty to misdemeanor tax charges, avoiding prosecution for his gun possession. If the federal judge signs off on the deal, Hunter will not face any jail time. The agreement has been criticized by many as favoritism towards the president's son.
Can we talk a little bit about the Hunter Biden plea deal and your reaction?
My first reaction is it continues to show the two-tier system in America. If you are the president's leading political opponent, the DOJ tries to literally put you in jail and give you prison time. If you are the president's son, you get a sweetheart deal. Now, this does nothing to our investigation. It actually should enhance our investigation because the DOJ should not be able to withhold any information now, saying that because of pending investigation, they should be able to provide Chairman Comer with any information that he requires.
Republican leaders like House Speaker Kevin McCarthy have called the agreement a sweetheart deal, which is unfair and in the benefit of Hunter Biden. Some political analysts believe, however, that the controversy surrounding Hunter would likely not hurt Joe Biden much in the elections due to the massive amount of corruption in previous administrations, especially the Trump administration.
A lot of people in the Department of Justice, the FBI, and other parts doing everything they can do to protect him, because if he falls, then a lot of other alleged congressional representatives may fall, might fall, including the Obamas, the Clintons, Bloomberg, Nancy Pelosi, John Kerry, and a lot of other tentacles that's been involved with doing business the same way that Joe Biden's been doing business, the same way that a lot of other government officials have been doing business for a great number of years.
Donald Trump has been using Hunter's scandal against Joe Biden for quite some time, while he himself is facing charges of 37 federal counts for his handling of classified documents in Florida and 34 felony counts in the state of New York. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, also did business with foreign governments while serving as an advisor in the White House. Will the controversy surrounding Hunter hurt his father's re-election bid?
I personally don't think it will. The reason being is because our politics are very polarizing. So on one side, they think that the cases don't mean anything if you're a Democrat. And on the other side, they believe that the case means everything. The reality is that the American media will play cover for Joe Biden. And so the people who aren't politically active, they won't really fully understand the context or the implications of this case, or in many ways, they may not even hear about it because it will be in and out of the news cycle and it won't be something that's hyper-focused. Unfortunately, our American media is very left-leaning. It's very biased, and they've shown more far more favorability towards Democratic candidates like Joe Biden.
Corruption is nothing new in the United States government and politics. However, it is occurring more in the open, and the two main political parties are using the likes of these scandals against their rival viciously. Politicians are applying their influence to turn verdicts in their favor and use their power in the House to investigate their opponents. When the Democrats held the House, it was Trump they were investigating, and now that the Republicans hold power, they're investigating Biden.
Quran Quest, a program on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The show is Quran Quest, where we study the verses of the Quran one by one to learn from them. And with us today is Sheikh Habib. Sheikh Habib, salamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I would like to extend my condolences to you and the listeners. We are on the 10 days of Muharram that will end with the martyrdom of our dear and beloved Imam, Imam Hussein ibn Ali, and his family members being captured by the enemies of Allah. My condolences to you, Brother Habib, and to all our listeners.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reward you for the sorrow. On Imam Hussein alayhi salam, our condolences to the Islamic Ummah on the loss of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, these sorrow days. And we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to grant us the shafa'ah, the intercession of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions.
Inshallah, our listeners will have us in their prayers on these nights. We're on chapter 70 of the Quran. Let's listen to verse 4 onwards, and we'll be back for today's discussion.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeeb. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
تعرج الملائكة والروح إليه في يوم كان مقداره 50,000
The angels and the spirit will ascend to him during a day the extent of which is 50,000 years.
فاصبر صبرا جميلا.
So be patient with gracious patience.
إنهم يرونه بعيدا.
Indeed, they see it as distant.
ونراه قريبا.
But we see it as near.
You just listened to chapter 70, verse 4 onwards from the Quran. Sheikh Habib, we were talking about this verse which said that the Day of Judgment is 50,000 years. The first question is that in different places, the time changes. In other words, time is relative. Are we sure that when God says 50,000 years, we mean 50,000 earth years?
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Of course, there is no, you know, when you look at the events that happen and unfold on the Day of Judgment, you're not only just standing there, there's also the concept of you walking on the Day of Judgment above hellfire. We talked about that verse